Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
There's a handout with 28 numbered quotations. I will call out the number as I read them. Light, that old and subtle stuff that is so important and mysterious that it was felt necessary to arrange a special creation for it when writing Genesis. End quote. Richard Feynman, Lectures on Physics. My objectives are two. First, to raise the question of the relation between the human mind and the world. I do this by comparing and contrasting Aristotle and Descartes on light. Second, to behold the mysterious reality of light in Einstein's special theory of relativity. I do this by highlighting the great importance of the ether in wave theories of light from Huygens to Maxwell, and then the radical implications of the rejection of the ether by Einstein. I just think that in a conference on light, there should be some mention of special relativity. Part one, mind-world relation, Aristotle and Descartes on light. A guiding question, is the real world colored? What is meant here by real world? For Descartes, the answer is clear. The real extended world means the material, non-mental world outside of the tiny region of the brain where mind meets matter. Descartes thought it was the pineal gland. Some contemporary neuroscientists think it is the supplementary motor area. On Descartes' account, there is much outside the mind, but inside the brain, of which we have no awareness, and to which his reductionist physics of matter and motion could be fruitfully applied. He tries this in his last book, The Passions of the Soul. I should say that I picked Descartes not because his physics is much good. Geometrical optics, refraction, and lenses is the only successful part of it. Rather, I picked Descartes because he is a pioneer in the removal of formal causality from the modern scientific consciousness. The Cartesian account of the mind-world relation contrasts radically with Aristotle and Aquinas, for whom the mind is the intellectual power of the rational soul. Soul in the Aristotelian Thomistic tradition is the form of an organic body. It is a holistic principle. It suffuses the body such that the parts of the ensouled body are what they are only in terms of the whole they compose. In contrast, in an artifact, the parts are what they are independently of the whole they compose. That's why an artifact can be disassembled and reassembled in a way that a living thing cannot. In Questions on the Soul, Thomas Aquinas says, quote, one, in reference to those operations like seeing that a soul carries out through bodily organs, its whole capability, its power, is in the whole body, but not in each part, because diverse parts of the body are fitted to diverse operations of the soul. Hence, a soul is in a particular part of its body, the eye, according to that power only, vision, which is directed toward the operations which the soul carries on through that part of its body. End quote. Questions on the Soul, question 10. Contrast this with Descartes in his Optics. Quote, two, we know that it is not properly because the mind is in the parts serving as organs to the exterior senses that it experiences sensation, but because it is in the brain. Thus, the mind is caused to perceive as many different qualities in bodies as there are varieties in the movements that they cause in the brain. End quote. Aristotle on light, De Anima 2.7. In De Anima 2.7, Aristotle says that, quote, three, every color has the potency to set in motion the transparent in act, and this is the nature of color. And for that reason, color is not visible without light, but of each thing, every color is seen in light. Hence, One must first say what light is. Now, there is such a thing as the transparent, and light is the act, energia, of the transparent as such. And in that in which it is, there is in potency darkness. Light is a sort of color of the transparent whenever it is in actuality, entelechia, by the agency of fire or something of that kind, end quote. Here we have color, light, darkness, the transparent in act, the transparent in potency. Well, light, sources of light, fire, the sun, color and colored things, and darkness are all familiar to us. But not so familiar here is the transparent in act and in potency. Hence his assertion that it is the nature of color to move the transparent in act is, at first glance, obscure. What is he getting at? My assignment for this conference is to present early modern and contemporary, not Aristotelian, theories of light, so let me just say that in general, Aristotle's accounts of things typically begin with what is right in front of us. That is because for Aristotle, the natural employment of our natural faculties, here vision, does give reliable access to reality. The ascent from things first for us to things first in themselves is possible. For Aristotle, and despite serious distortions, there is an ultimate harmony between the human soul and the world. As he says, quote 4, the soul is, in a way, all things, end quote. How? By receipt of the forms of things, forms in the category of substance, like cat form, dog form, and forms in the categories of accident, like colors. Therefore, properly understood, our sense perceptions do resemble their causes. But in the case of color, vision, and light, there is a complication. When it gets dark, we see things but not as colored. As the day wears on towards evening and nightfall, the green of the trees fades into shades of gray and charcoal. This is something obvious, right in front of us, every day and night. In modern scientific language, color vision depends on the intensity of the environing light. When there is sufficient light, we have the transparent medium in act. As it gets dark out, we still have the transparent, but in potency. Color can affect the transparent in act, but not in potency. As for the transparent, Aristotle says, it's a nature present in transparent things. It is present throughout the cosmos because we see light from the stars, and it is not a body, otherwise you'd have two bodies in the same place. Illumination, the actualization of the transparent, is for Aristotle, as we've noted, not a physical motion, a kinesis, but occurs instantaneously. Because as soon as we see the sunrise in the east, we see all at once the light all across the sky to the west. The transparent medium is Aristotle's closest approach to electromagnetic field. A last point on Aristotle, the Greek word entelechia, often translated actuality, is a value word. The entelechia of a thing is its perfection or completion. So light, as the entelechia of the transparent, is good, like it says in the Bible, Genesis 1:4. Well, what about Descartes' very different conception? From Descartes, The World or Treatise on Light. Chapter 1 of The World is titled, quote, On the Difference Between Our Sensations and the Things That Produce Them. For Descartes, our sense perceptions do not resemble their causes. Rather, only the geometrical features of bodies, sizes and shapes, and their local motions are faithfully reported by the senses to the mind. Here is an important Cartesian text on the relation between the mind and the world. Quote 5, If we are to get a clear view of what sort of certainty attaches to the senses, we must distinguish three grades of sensory response. The first is limited to the immediate stimulation of the bodily organs by external objects. This can consist in nothing but the motion of the particles of the organs and any change of shape and position proceeding from this motion. The second grade comprises all that immediately results in the mind as a result of its being united with a bodily organ, which is affected in this way, such as the perceptions of pain, pleasure, thirst, hunger, colors, sound, taste, smell, heat, cold, and the like, which arise from the union and, as it were, intermingling of mind and body in the pineal gland, a small part of the brain, as explained in the sixth meditation. The third grade includes all the judgments about things outside us, which we have been accustomed to make from our earlier years, judgments which are occasioned by the movements of these bodily organs, end quote. For Descartes, most emphatically, the real world is not colored. Cartesian mind, in fundamental contrast to Aristotle's soul, is largely separate from the world. Thus, color is an intramental representation, an intramental representation of the interactions of colorless corpuscles in and outside the body. What do we think? How many believe my sport jacket is navy blue? How many have heard of the quantum theory of electrons and photons? What color are the electrons? QED, you know, quantum electrodynamics, Feynman's little book. What color are they, the photons and electrons? They're not. How many believe that my sport jacket is not colored? I think there is confusion about this issue, at least for those of us with some background in natural science. Here is Richard Feynman in his famous 1963 lectures on physics, on color vision and its material basis in the two types of retinal cells: cones for seeing colored things in bright light, rods for dark adapted vision of things seen without color, an echo of Aristotle. Quotation 6, the variations in light intensity for which one can adapt is over 1,000,000 to 1. Nature does not do all this with just one kind of cell, but she passes her job from the bright light seeing cells, the cones, to low intensity dark adapted cells, the rods. Among the interesting consequences of this shift from cones to rods is, first, that there is no color, and second, that there is a difference in the relative brightness of differently colored objects, end quote. There is no color. A page later, Feynman says, quote, 7, as we know, white light can be split by a prism into a whole spectrum of wavelengths which appear to us to have different colors. That is what colors are, of course, appearances, end quote. Finally, Feynman addresses the fact, well known to painters, that certain colors, red, green, blue, can be combined, mixed, to produce many other colors. He asks, quote, why do colors behave in this way, i.e., we can combine some to make others? He answers, quotation 8, these three pieces of information, absorptions of the red, blue, and green by corresponding pigments in the eye, are somehow maneuvered in the brain or in the eye, or somewhere, to decide what the resultant color is, end quote. Somehow maneuvered in the brain or the eye or somewhere to yield the color that appears to us. Modern natural science is pretty good on material causality, here of color vision, but still, ever since Descartes, it has nothing to say about what the Aristotelian Thomistic tradition would call formal causality. Descartes' rejection of that tradition is radical. Quotation 9. I should say to them, the scholastic philosophers, that unless I'm mistaken, the whole problem that they face with their matter derives only from their wanting to distinguish it from its own proper quantity and from its outward extension, i.e., from the property it has of occupying space. In this, however, I am willing that they think themselves correct, for I have no intention of stopping to contradict them. But they should also not find it strange if I suppose that the quantity of the matter I have described does not differ from its substance, nor should they find it strange if I conceive of its extension or the property it has of occupying space, not as an accident, but as its true form and its essence. And those are really fighting words. Let us turn to Descartes' unusual theory of light in this geometrized world. His account of light is tediously detailed, and I can only give you a sketch. The curvilinear, in some way circular, motion of Cartesian matter throughout the universe is essential for his theory of light. Quotation 10. All the motions that take place in the world are in some way circular. That is to say, when a body leaves its place, it always enters into that of another, and the latter into that of still another, and so on down to the last, which occupies in the same instant the place left open by the first. End quote. Descartes' universe is full of matter, corpuscles, patches of extension in motion. Although Descartes has a law of inertia, it's his first law of nature. There is no void in which something could move inertially in a straight line, as in Newtonian space. Corpuscles are distinguished by their size and speed into three classes, called by Descartes elements, as follows. Quotation 11. I conceive the first, which may be called the element of fire, although it's not sensible fire, as the most subtle and penetrating fluid in the world. As for the second, which may be called the element of air, I conceive this too to be very subtle fluid in comparison with the third, but compared with the first, we need to attribute some size and shape to each of its parts and to imagine them as more or less round and joined together like grains of sand or dust. Beyond these two elements, I accept only a third, namely that of earth. I judge its parts to be proportionately larger than and more slowly moving than those of the second, as those of the second are in comparison to those of the first, and indeed I think it is enough to conceive of it as one or more large masses, whose parts have very little or no motion that might cause them to change their position with respect to one another. Now, I cannot find any such forms in the world, except the three I have described, small and fast, big and slow, and then the middling that move middling. For the form that I have attributed to the first element consists in its parts moving with such a great speed and being so tiny that there are no other bodies able to stop them. In addition, they need to have no determinate size, shape, or position. The form of the second element consists in its parts having such a middling motion and size that just as there are many causes in the world which could increase their motion and diminish their size, there are as many that could do the opposite. And so they always remain balanced in a dynamic, steady state, as it were, in the same middling condition. And the form of the third element consists in its parts being so large or so closely joined together that they always have the force to resist the motions of other bodies. In this regard, if we consider in general all the bodies of which the universe is composed, we will find among them only three kinds which can be called large and which can count among the principal parts, namely, the sun and the fixed stars as the first kind, the heavens as the second, we call it outer space, and the earth with the planets and the comets as the third. That is why we have every reason to think that the sun and the fixed stars have as their form nothing other than the first element, the heavens the second, and the earth with the planets and comets the third. End quote. The action that is light. Quotation 12. The sun and stars incessantly turning much faster than and in the same direction as the parts of the heavens have the force in moving from the center toward the circumference to push the parts of the heavens in all directions, just as they push one another. This is centrifugal, center-fleeing, not centripetal force. I won't get into it. Descartes lacks Newton's third law, which we invoke when we go around a corner fast in a car and we're in the rider's seat and we feel the car pushing us in, but we feel ourselves pushed out against the door. Descartes is trying to exploit that phenomenon, but I don't know if he gets it right. At any rate, this takes place by an action instantaneous centrifugal pressure throughout the universe from the sources of light, first element, pressing on our eye. This takes place by an action that I must soon explain exactly as I can, for I tell you here that it is this action of the heavens and the stars on our eyes that we shall take to be light. End quote. To cut to the chase, for Descartes, light consists in one, lines of centrifugal force or pressure propagated instantaneously from sun and stars to our eyes, and they push on our optical nerves into our brains and the pineal gland, that's the first grade of sensory response. Secondly, giving rise in our minds, second grade of sensory response, to the sensation of light. Three, as if the celestial bodies were per se bright, that's the third grade of sensory response, the erroneous judgment that our perceptions resemble their causes. End quote. Descartes has a very clever theory of how color vision arises from the way parts of the second elements, which are spherical and they spin in certain ways. I won't get into that. This completes part one of my talk, Aristotle, Descartes, mind-world relation. In part two, ether and its demise, light in Einstein's special relativity, which I'll only touch on. I'll read only from the underlined portion of the quotations. I start with Huygens, Treatise on Light, 1678, published 1690. Quote 13, no one has yet given even a probable explanation of light, that is, why it travels in straight lines, and how rays coming from an infinitude of different directions cross one another without disturbing one another. We say photons don't bounce off each other. Light is interpenetrable. Were that not the case, the whole vast universe of wireless communication and technology, from old-time radios to televisions to smartphones and all of that IT stuff, would not be possible. So the interpenetrability of light is a crucial phenomenon. Quote 14, we cannot help believing that light consists in the motion of a certain material, at least in the true philosophy where one believes all natural phenomena to be mechanical effects, end quote. What does the word mechanical here mean? The mechanical view was a widely held conception of nature well expressed by Newton, a principal founder, in the 1686 preface to the Principia. Quote 15, I derive from the celestial phenomena the forces of gravity with which bodies tend to the sun and the several planets, and from these forces I deduce the motions of the planets, the comets, the moon, and the sea. I wish we could derive the rest of the phenomena of nature by the same kind of reasoning from mechanical principles, that is, particles and forces, for I am induced by many reasons to suspect that they may all, there's that word all again, depend upon certain forces by which the particles of bodies, by some causes hitherto unknown, are either mutually impelled towards one another and cohere, or are repelled and recede. These forces being unknown, philosophers have hitherto attempted the search of nature in vain. That obviously excludes formal cause. Huygens continues, quote 16, if in addition light requires time for its passage, a point we shall presently consider, it will then follow that this motion is impressed upon the matter gradually and hence is propagated as that of sound by surfaces and spherical waves. I call these waves because of their resemblance to those which are formed when one throws a pebble into water and which represent gradual propagation in circles, although produced by a different cause and confined to a plane surface. End quote. Quotation 17. In my opinion, This motion of luminous bodies cannot be better explained than by supposing that those which are fluid, such as a flame and apparently the sun and stars, are composed of particles that float about in a much more subtle medium, which sets them in rapid motion, causing them to strike against the still smaller particles of the surrounding ether. The question next arises as to the nature of the medium in which is propagated this motion produced by luminous bodies. I have called it ether. Quote 18. Nothing prevents our imagining the particles of the ether as endowed with a hardness almost perfect and with an elasticity. Spring-like Hooke's law forces between any two particles, as great as we please. But although we do not understand the cause of elasticity, we cannot fail to observe that most bodies possess this property. It is not unnatural, therefore, to suppose that it is a characteristic also of the small, invisible particles of the ether. Finally, the wave theory of light permits interpenetrability of waves from multiple sources. Quote 19, another and more remarkable property of light is that when rays come from different or even opposite directions, each produces its effect without disturbance from the other, unlike bodies, which are impenetrable and bounce off each other. That's Huygens, wave theory of light. Newton, in his Optics, a treatise of the reflections, refractions, inflections, and colors of light. Quote 20, query 28, are not all hypotheses erroneous in which light is supposed to consist in pression, that's Descartes, or motion propagated through a fluid medium, that's Huygens, and waves. And if light consisted in pression or motion propagated either in instant or in time, it would bend into the shadow. But light is never known to follow crooked passages, nor to bend into the shadow. To explain the unusual refraction of Iceland crystal by pression or motion propagated has not hitherto been attempted to my knowledge, except by Huygens. Now, Newton gives several criticisms of Huygens, most notably that the luminiferous ether should pervade the universe, but the motions of planets and comets show no slowing down due to ether drag. A dense fluid can be of no use for explaining the phenomena of nature, the motions of the planets and comets being better explained without it. It serves only to disturb and retard the motions of those great bodies and make the frame of nature languish. It, ether, ought to be rejected, and if it be rejected, the hypothesis that light consists in pression or motion propagated through such a medium are rejected with it, end quote. Newton gives two main reasons for rejecting the existence of ether. First, light casts sharp shadows, unlike water and sound waves, which can bend around obstacles. Second, ether should cause some degree of slowing by planets and comets as they continuously pass through it. Yet no such ether drag has ever been observed. For these reasons, Newton argues that the ether should be rejected, and therewith the wave theory of light. Waves without a medium, whose undulating particles collectively constitute the waves, that's not conceivable within the mechanical view of nature. Accordingly, Newton proposes a corpuscular theory of light. Query 29, that's quote 21. Are not the rays of light very small bodies emitted from shining substances? For such bodies will pass through uniform mediums in right lines without bending into the shadow, which is the nature of the rays of light. End quote. Newton's first reason for rejecting the ether, light casts sharp shadows, we know to be wrong. Given objects and apertures of sufficiently small size, about the wavelength of light, in the instruments used to observe light, interference and diffraction patterns appear. The wavelength of light is on the order of a thousandth of a millimeter, which can be realized with gratings and crystal lattices. The crucial experiments deciding in favor of the wave theory of light were first performed by Young and Fresnel around the turn of the 19th century. This set the background for James Clerk Maxwell's famous studies of electricity and magnetism, namely, light is a wave in the luminiferous ether whose structure and function remain to be found. Maxwell. His 1864 paper, A Dynamical Theory of the Electromagnetic Field. Quote 22. The most obvious mechanical phenomenon in electrical and magnetical experiments is the mutual action by which bodies in certain states set each other in motion while still at a sensible distance from each other. But Weber has found it necessary to assume that the force between two electric particles depends on their relative velocity, unlike gravitation, as well as on their distance, end quote. This new technical detail, velocity-dependent forces, in addition to position-dependent forces, greatly complicates the equations of electromagnetism. Earlier theories of electrostatics and magnetostatics succeeded by positing forces acting at a distance instantaneously through empty space, as in Newton's gravitational theory. In these theories of electrostatics and magnetostatics, the surrounding medium played no role. It was empty space. In view of the difficulties produced by velocity-dependent electromagnetic forces, Maxwell offers a new type of theory in which the medium surrounding the electrified and magnetized bodies is itself active. In this new Maxwellian theory, there are no forces acting at a distance instantaneously, as was the case in Newton's gravitational theory. Quote 23, the theory I propose may therefore be called a theory of the electromagnetic field because it has to do with a space in the neighborhood of the electric and magnetic bodies. And it may be called a dynamical theory because it assumes that in that space there is matter in motion by which the electromagnetic phenomena are produced, end quote. Quote 24, even in so-called vacua, there is always enough of matter left to receive and transmit the undulations of heat and light. And it is because the transmission of these radiations is not greatly altered when transparent bodies of measurable densities are substituted for the so-called vacuum that we are obliged to admit that the undulations are those of an ethereal substance and not of gross matter, end quote. Quotation 25, it appears therefore that certain phenomena in electricity and magnetism, not just light and heat, lead to the same conclusion as those of optics, namely, that there is an ethereal medium pervading all bodies, end quote. Maxwell then describes phenomena in which electric and magnetic effects are interrelated. In particular, electric and magnetic fields, changing in space and time, can produce each other such that electromagnetic waves can be generated. They propagate in the ether with a velocity that can be theoretically calculated. Quote 26, this velocity of electromagnetic waves is so nearly that of light that it seems we have strong reason to conclude that light itself is an electromagnetic disturbance in the form of waves propagated through the electromagnetic field according to electromagnetic laws. End quote. Quote 27, Einstein, the theoretical discovery of an electromagnetic wave spreading with the speed of light, is one of the greatest achievements in the history of science, end quote. But despite Maxwell's historic achievement, there remains the fundamental problem for that time. And this has been from Huygens to Maxwell, a couple hundred years. How does the ether work? Recall Newton's objection in the optics that the lack of any measurable slowing in the motions of the solar system argues against ether. Therefore, if ether exists at all, it must be so subtle it does not interact with ordinary bodies, the planets. But in refraction, light rays bend at the interface of transparent bodies because the speed of light's a little less in the denser medium. Therefore, ether does interact with ordinary bodies. This is perplexing. In any case, we should be able to detect the presence of the ether by the variation in the speed of light with the direction of the Earth's motion around the sun over the course of a year, since at some point the Earth must be moving into the ether and 6 months later be moving away from it. The Earth could be stationary relative to the ether at a moment, but not for a whole year. It's just like with sound. The speed of sound in air near the surface of the Earth is about 760 miles per hour. Thus, if a car is moving through that air mass at 60 miles per hour, sound from the source down the road ahead of the car will be 760 plus 60 equals 820 miles per hour relative to the car. If the car turns around and moves away from the source of sound at 60 miles per hour, the speed of sound relative to the car will be 760 minus 60 equals 700 miles per hour. The speeds of light and sound must depend on the direction in which the receiver is moving in the respective media, air and ether. The general idea that the speed of light should vary with the motions of sources and receivers in and through the ether led to a series of experiments, beginning with that of Michelson and Morley in 1887. Needless to say, the apparatus had to be exquisitely sensitive to detect, through shifting interference patterns, minute variations in the almost unimaginably high speed of light. At the speed of light, you could go around the Earth 7 times in 1 second. In 2009, optical resonator experiments confirmed the absence of any ether wind at the 10 to the minus 17th level. All the results of these experiments since 1887 have been negative. Quote 28, Einstein's radical solution. Our attempts to discover the properties of the ether led to difficulties and contradictions. It does and does not interact with ordinary matter. After such bad experiences, this is the moment to forget the ether completely and to try never to mention its name. Let us now write down the 2 facts which have been sufficiently confirmed by experiment. First, the velocity of light in empty space always has its standard value, c equals 186,000 miles per second, independent of the motion of the source or receiver of light. Second, from Galileo, 2 chief world systems, and 2 coordinate systems or frames of reference, moving uniformly relative to each other, all the laws of nature are exactly identical, and there is no way of distinguishing absolute uniform motion. Our new assumptions are now, first, the velocity of light in vacuo is the same in all coordinate systems moving uniformly relative to each other. 2, all the laws of nature are the same in all coordinate systems moving uniformly relative to each other. The relativity theory begins with these 2 assumptions, end quote. From Einstein and Infeld, The Evolution of Physics. From Einstein's 2 basic assumptions, The three famous and jarring results for space-time and local motion can be easily derived. Colloquially stated, they are, first, time dilation. A clock in motion runs slower than when at rest. Lorentz contraction. A measuring rod in motion along its length is shortened compared to its length when at rest. Third, relativity of simultaneity. Two events simultaneous for one observer are sequential for another observer moving relative to the first. And again, by assumption two, Galileo's principle of relativity. One cannot tell by any observation, measurement, or experiment whether one is at rest or moving uniformly. Hence, all observers in uniform relative motion give equally valid descriptions of phenomena. Contra Aristotle, there is no absolute rest. Thus, anybody moving uniformly with respect to somebody at rest is entitled to consider himself to be at rest and the other person to be moving uniformly. That's from David Merman's excellent little book, Space and Time and Special Relativity. But the relativity of uniform motion, there is no absolute rest, from Galileo to Newton was not so disturbing because in pre-relativity physics, good clocks ran at the same rate, and meter sticks were 1 meter long, regardless of anybody's motion. And in pre-relativity physics, the speed of light varied with the motions of sources and receivers, like sound. Now, given the constancy of the speed of light, clocks are running at different rates and meter sticks are less than a meter long, depending on the relative motions of observers. These effects, although easy to derive, are hard to believe. So with Aristotle and Descartes, we do psychophysics. Here we do psychotherapy. These effects, although easy to derive, and they really are just logically immediate, they're easy to derive, but hard to believe, especially when they seem, at first glance, to imply that 2 meter sticks are both shorter and longer than each other, and two clocks are running both slower and faster than each other. I'm about done. I just want to say, concluding point on special relativity. With clocks running at different rates and meter sticks less than a meter long, depending on motion, is there anything other than the speed of light that is fixed, invariant, absolute, the same for all observers? Well, yes, there is. And were there a blackboard, I'd write it down. It's a mathematical expression for the Lorentz invariant interval. It's a little strange, but what it says, this will be technical. What the invariant interval of special relativity says is that the square of the distance light could travel in the time between two events minus the square of the distance between the events is the same for all observers. It has the same numerical value for all observers of the two events. It's always struck me a little strange. What are to make of this? What are we to make of this? You know, when Einstein heard of the abuses to which his theory of relativity was being put, you know, everything depends on my frame of reference. I got a different frame of reference from you. Therefore, I can do whatever I want, because values are relative, said Einstein. Well, of course, it's numerical values that are relative, different for different observers, not moral values. Einstein said at one point that he wished he had not called it the theory of relativity, but should have called it the theory of invariances. And this expression for the Lorentz invariant interval is the prime example of something that's absolute, constant, and invariant. That's all.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.